soil is a living organism. The communicator in it and the master of ceremonies are the mycelial networks and the fungi. That is the brain of soil. So we've got to make decisions to protect the fungi from the ultraviolet light, to protect those initial bacteria, and the biological carpet is what does it, and that triggers and activates the soil's brain mycelium. When you're starting at sand and you've got to start life again, life begins in the top millimeter. If we can't protect that top millimeter from ultraviolet light, we have no hope of healing the deserts of the world.
Hello, and welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast, where you'll hear one conversation after another that puts a spring in your step. We are talking to innovators around the world who are solving some of the world's most vexing problems and winning, and they still think the future's bright. Okay, so we're going to get started today with another amazing guest, Roger Savory. Roger is an expert in ecology. He's a rancher. He is an expert all over the world about how we recover from the way the planet is turning to desert more and more. He points out, with the use of some amazing history, that we were once lush in places that we now think of as barren and dry, not in remote places all over the world, but in places like around Los Angeles and other places where urban cities butt right up against the desert. That wasn't the way it always was. And Roger has a great deal of knowledge and some fresh ideas about how we change that, and we can leave an amazing planet for our kids two generations from now. The way he looks at things that are possible right now with rather simple fundamental changes is extraordinary. Roger talks about things like we can't be pursuing sustainable agriculture because the way we're doing it now is really not sustainable. But if we get into something called regenerative agriculture and we look at things in a circular loop, oh, the examples he gives us of the successes he's had, this is the world we want to leave for our children. So welcome, Roger Savory.
Thank you for having me.
I am so delighted to have you just 2.5 weeks after I first heard you speak at a wonderful conference in Burlington, Vermont called Sea Change, where they invited 2 days worth of wonderful speakers from every corner of the world of making the world a better place. And you were one of the speakers I knew instantly that I was going to need to interview you. And I took copious notes in my little special notebook. So I came up with the questions pretty fast that I wanted to ask you about. So let's start with this concept that really impressed me. That, you know, the gist of what I took away from your message at Sea Change was that, you know, we should be making decisions for the lives we want for our grandchildren. That is a super important concept in, you know, just our day-to-day lives, the things we buy, the things we consume, the things we vote for, and so forth and so on. Talk to us about this concept of caring about two generations from now. Let's start right there.
So thank you. I think where it stems from is, it's while studying deserts and studying the fact that two-thirds of the planet, humans have turned it into desert, and then working as a consultant for nearly 30 years, wherever I've been, I've never heard anyone, when they've described the future landscape description in a holistic context for how they want their lives to be, I've never ever had someone describe, we want to live in a desert, we want to have polluted air, and we want our rivers to dry up.
Right.
No one's ever described that. And yet, whether I was working in the United Arab Emirates, whether I was working in the Namib Desert, it doesn't matter where I was working, one decision at a time, humans created those deserts from lush ecosystems. We've got the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. We've got the Tigris and Euphrates. We've got the breadbasket of humanity. We've got NASA showing villages every 20 kilometers across the entire Sahara Desert. We've got petroglyphs of elephants and giraffe and rhino in the middle of the Sahara. We've got Herodotus in the 5th century before Christ, when he accompanied Alexander the Great's armies, and Alexander sent his armies down the north coast of Africa through what is today Tunisia, Libya, Morocco. And Herodotus wrote that the greatest problem for Alexander the Great's armies was cutting a pathway through the teak forests for the chariots to pass.
Come on.
So how did we go from teak forests to, when we watched the Libyan war on TV, it was just sand? When we watched the Gulf War, when we crossed out of Saudi Arabia into Kuwait, soldiers were driving over sand, but they were all wearing raincoats. So the rainfall hasn't changed, but somehow, one decision at a time, humans turned it from functioning ecosystems into desert.
This is a really, really key point that I found hope in. I know what you said sounds pretty hopeless, but what you're going to say, what you're going to tell us about, gave me so much hope. So I'm glad that you brought it right down to reality, right here at the beginning, because it was a one choice at a time.
Yeah.
That's probably the way we're going to get us out of this mess too, right?
Exactly. It's literally that simple. One decision at a time, we created a desert because we didn't know, we weren't thinking about the future. Yeah. Right. But now if we think about a future and we say we want our low rainfall areas to be abundant, and have biodiverse grasslands and savannas and trees and everything, and no one can imagine that. But one decision at a time, we can go in the direction we want. And I really know this because with working with families, when we create their holistic context and we have a family describe the future that they want, what I found is I always have families create a holistic context where they describe how they want their lives to be socially, economically, and environmentally. I always just say, look, just 3 years from now. And then when I go back and visit 3 years later, everything they desired to achieve, they've achieved, and they now have to describe another better future even further out. But if I said to them the first time, oh, no, that's not good enough, think further, it would have been overwhelming. So we can take things in small bite-sized pieces, achieve them, but we've got to have a magnetic north. We've got to know where we're going. And unfortunately, we don't do this as a matter of practice. We don't do it when we create policies. We don't do it when we're thinking about our family businesses. Very few groups think long-term, how do we want our lives to be? And that's why we've created the deserts. So my thing is we can do this. And yes, for what I'm working on, I picked a rather big way out there target, but it's not unrealistic because of all the baby steps we've taken over the last 30 years. I know it's achievable.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go right into this concept of regeneration, regenerative agriculture. The word regenerative is popping up all over the place in the public zeitgeist. I'm sure most of the people have heard it pop up related to how we live a more regenerative lifestyle in the work-life balance, or there's just a million applications of it. I interviewed Paul Hawken, who, is responsible for the largest climate mitigation project in history called Project Drawdown. And his new way of talking about that whole subject is in living a life that is regenerative. That I will make sure in the show notes, there's a link to that episode. But this is a term that we're all going to be very, very familiar with very soon. So start us off in what we should know about how I'm assuming agriculture has been kind of a one-way extractive process, and regenerative agriculture is more paying attention to a circle.
Well, I can go really deeply on this. And so I'm going to take a brief moment to give a short version of a really deep subject.
Okay.
So if you realize that 26 civilizations before ours have failed, and they all failed because of agriculture. So let's look at, why did they fail because of agriculture? And we look at all civilizations were started where there was a high animal population.
Okay.
So there was a migration of steppes, saiga. There was a migration of these animals. Whatever it was animals maintaining a biodiverse grassland ecosystem in what we call a brittle environment. Now, humans figured out a way of trapping many of these animals, whether it's running them off a cliff, whether it's making the rock wall tunnels, into a kill zone. You know, all around the world, we find where these vast numbers of animals were killed. Now, a civilization or a city of clans, of tribes, people was able to develop because there was abundant resources. And as long as these animals migrated and arrived every year, they could kill and process the meat, the hides, the tusks, the ivory, whatever. And then they could trade that with other groups for iron, for spears or whatever, et cetera, et cetera. So the basis of a city was always a lot of animals. Then human population exploded because there was a lot of food. So now they needed to kill more animals. At some point, a tipping point, you might have heard that in language right now, a tipping point was reached. And that tipping point was reached where the people now had to kill more animals than the animals could sustain themselves. Now the animals die off. When the animals in a brittle environment die off, well, now there's not enough food. So now we invent agriculture to feed our cities because the animals that we were harvesting are gone. So now we start planting grains and stuff to supplement our feed. But then about 10,000 years ago, we invent the plow to turn the soil over. That now sterilizes and kills the soil life. So this whole thing of agriculture, it was always what we invented after we'd killed all the animals. And then the plowing of the soil is always the final step in sterilizing the soil and turning it to a desert that can no longer produce food to feed people. Mm. So there's this consistent, you know, and I've studied all of them. They all have the same process. Wild animals killed, crops invented, soil sterilized, soil dead, civilization collapses. So agriculture has always started with, you know, there, and it's always been extractive. Extracting the animals, extracting what they could get out of the soil, extractive. Now, regenerative agriculture, using our new way of thinking and creating policies and plans, which is holistic management, we use that holistic management framework. And part of it is a future land description where we describe what the land would have to look like hundreds of years into the future to allow our grandchildren be living these same lives. Well, we couldn't use sustainable agriculture because why would we want to sustain it just before it's a desert? So we had to come up with regenerative agriculture because we don't want to sustain this low level. We want to regenerate and fix all those soils and fix those migrations of bison and fix it all. So we've got to regenerate it. And it's on all levels. It's regenerate our forests, regenerate our oceans, regenerate our grasslands, regenerate our societies and communities, especially our rural ones. So that's why we call it regenerative agriculture. But it's based on thinking holistically.
You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new, more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness. Okay, so you bring your expertise from a very unusual growing up. Talk to us about who your father was and how you got here, how the kind of environment that caused you to think so much outside the box and offer all this fresh insight.
If I'm to believe what I was told, a stork delivered me. But that's probably not what happened. So our family, when I've analyzed each generation has kind of made a significant change to humanity, whether it was Thomas Savery starting the Industrial Revolution with the steam train, whether it was my grandfather, Jimmy Savery, building the world's largest dam and having an amazing impact on civil engineering, whether it was my father with his holistic management and the four missing keys, those four missing keys being the need to understand that the world functions in wholes and patterns, that came from Jan Smuts, the role of herding animals in brittle environments, and the role of pack hunting predators in brittle environments, and obviously the last one being the brittle environments. So those were the things that my father put into the world's lexicon that were new, so to speak, connecting the dots. And then, you know, I, through osmosis, just kind of started there and have had to continue. And you can't have two, you know, alpha male buffalo bulls in the same paddock. We butt heads too much. So he's working on policy and holistic management at that level. And I looked at the next problem, which was, okay, 2/3 of the world has been turned into a desert. I think that's the next major issue we've got to regenerate and plan on. And so that's where I've dived into the mental gymnastics.
It's like when you talk us through your way of thinking about what's going on with the soils on our planet, it's like you put together the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that we can instantly see a new picture of the future once we've got it going. Just get us started on this concept of, well, you're very famous for talking about the biological carpet. How about if we start there, Roger? Like, what's wrong with the soils that we got?
Well, I think the first thing we have to understand is I look at the world from the point of view of a whole. I see a whole human. And you as a whole human, do you realize that you've got more bacteria cells in you than you've got human cells?
Yes.
So what is a whole human? You know, exactly. Right. Now, as a whole human, if I take you out of your family, will your family continue to function or will it collapse?
I'm pretty important in my family. No, I'm just kidding. No, they would do just fine without me.
They'd be now. Okay, so if you're removed from your whole family, your whole family continues. But if I take your heart out of your whole, will you continue to function or will you collapse?
No. Right.
Okay, so we need to understand that there are holes within holes. Okay. Now, the next biggest hole above you, I'm not even going to ask you because most people don't get it, but the next biggest hole above you is green growing plants.
Okay.
Without them, you can't get oxygen. So, you know, if we remove your heart, you collapse. And if we remove all the trees, you collapse. But if we remove you from your family continues. So people struggle to understand these holes and how they fit together. Now, when we look at soil, what I realized was that soil is a living organism, just like you're a living organism, but you're made of more bacteria cells than human cells. Well, yeah, we know, yeah, it depends on, you know, I most people can't even see these numbers, but they talk about a trillion life forms being a teaspoon of healthy soil. So it's too much. And we only know this from electron microscopes and DNA because we've never actually seen it. There's so much complexity to soil. So one of the things I figured out when I began to see that, okay, hold on, soil isn't the stuff we walk on. It's this complex living organism. And that is now if you think about it, humans plowed up soil. It's called dirt. We disrespect it. We build houses out of it. We bury our dead in it. You know, it never meant anything. But when you suddenly realize that, no, this is actually a complex living organism, then you start thinking about it differently. You're a pretty woman. Do you realize that you've got 134 different organisms living on a single eyelash?
Well, I'm a science nerd, so I have read that book.
Yeah. So, I mean,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. It's crazy.
It's crazy, this complexity. Well, it's the same with soil. So then I asked myself a couple of simple questions. I said, you know, what is the difference between sand and soil? Can you answer that, science nerd?
I would think that sand is mostly silica, like pretty one-dimensional. Okay, it has clay and other things in it, but soil probably has, it's probably down to the biodiversity that you have. It's got like many different kinds of elements, and then there's all this organic.
You've answered it, but you over-answered it. The only difference between sand and soil is life.
Okay.
It's sand. Until we add life to it, then it becomes soil. It's as simple as that. Okay, so now let me ask another simple question. What does all life need to live?
I think it starts with photosynthesis, but maybe oxygen.
Close, but it's energy. All life needs energy.
Okay.
Now, below the ground, what is the source of that energy? And you've just given the answer. It's photosynthesis.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we ask the next question, what's the difference between a fertile soil and an infertile soil? No, quantity of life. Okay, so if we want a fertile soil, we've got to have lots of life. Lots of life requires lots of photosynthesis, pumping energy in to support that life. So it's as simple as that. We can have sand or we can have fertile soils just based on the decisions we make. How can we protect that life in the soils and pump as much energy into it year-round? Well, I guarantee agriculture does the exact opposite of that.
Yeah.
We plow our soils, so the microorganisms that live in the top millimeter get taken 10 inches down and they die. The ones that come from 10 inches down up to the surface, they die. Them dying releases the nitrogen in their bodies. And that's what we think, oh, you know, when we plow up virgin land, oh, it has such a boost. The boost is from killing life.
Right.
That's why traditionally you had 3 years of slash and burn, plow, and then they had to move on to a new piece of land because after 3 years they'd killed all the life in the soil. Mm. Life is a living organism, complex living organism. We have to protect it from ultraviolet light, and we have to get photosynthesis, plants photosynthesizing, pumping energy under all year round to get it as healthy and fertile as possible. And it's as simple as that when you break it down to the simple components. Mm. Now, what in our management is doing that? Very little. But now people are beginning to understand cover cropping. You know, because you know, we've been able to explain these concepts to people and they're beginning to get it. And that's why a lot of regenerative agriculture talks about cover cropping. It's just based on that very simple concept of creating healthy soils.
You have a great story about something that you observed in Zimbabwe after they put this in practice.
So, yeah, a lot of people ask me, well, what's the fastest you've ever fixed a piece of land? And I get to go, tap, tap, tap. It had nothing to do with me. It was all coincidence. But we turned a piece of land around basically in 6 weeks. We went from red, hard, capped soil with shale underneath it, absolutely no organic matter. We did a biological carpet, 100 meters by 100 meters. We had 600 cattle and a bunch of goats and sheep sleep on it for a week. They put an inch layer of dung and urine, and that was enough to protect it from ultraviolet light. And then this was in the dry season, and then 2 weeks later it rained. Well, the first thing that happened after the rain was millions, and I literally mean millions. I'm not speaking figuratively. Millions of mushrooms germinated and started growing. But I have never seen so many species of mushrooms. Really? There were little blue ones, there were big ones, there were fat ones, there were pink ones, there were yellow ones. I have never seen so many mushrooms. And it was just covered in this carpet of mushrooms. And then the mushrooms all dried up, wilted, and died. And on about day 10, it looked like a chia pet. Millions more little green grass plants started germinating and growing. And 6 weeks later, we had some of the grasses were overhead high, but we had this whole biodiversity of grasses. And where it really triggered me with, okay, this is what's going on, was we had a group of about 70 women coming in every day from the villages who were coming to cut thatching grass. And as they walked past this plot every day, they were fine walking past. But then one day, this old woman went, they make this noise, and she made this noise. And she just grabbed these young children and she just rushed into this plot. And she said, this is the grass we were telling you about that we used to make our bridal baskets from when we were children. She hadn't seen it in about 50 years. But the fungi had tapped on the grass root and told it was safe to germinate, and it had germinated and grown. Since that occasion, we've seen the same thing occur in Canada, a new grass that the University of Saskatchewan hadn't recorded in 150 years. And then in Australia, a legume called Townsville lucerne that went extinct in 1979 reappeared on one of our biological plots 7 years ago, and in mass. So these plant seeds are just sitting in the soil waiting for that symbiotic relationship for the fungi to tap them and say, it's safe to germinate and grow now, go ahead. Now, you think about that. So this soil, I said, is a living organism. The communicator in it and the master of ceremonies are the mycelial networks and the fungi. That is the brain of soil. So we've got to make decisions to protect the fungi from the ultraviolet light, to protect those initial bacteria, and the biological carpet is what does it, and that triggers and activates the soil's brain mycelium.
So do I have this right? Like the most important part of the soil must be like the top millimeter?
And when you're starting at sand,
yeah.
When you're starting at sand and you've got to start life again, life begins in the top millimeter.
Right. And that, you know, this is what blew me away in the talk I heard you give at the event I was at, was that you remind us that ultraviolet light is a killer.
It's a sterilizer.
It's a sterilizer.
So if we can't protect that top millimeter from ultraviolet light, we have no hope of healing the deserts of the world. None. Nothing.
None. Okay. So then you talked about this amazing relationship between animal dung and that top millimeter. Give us a little bit more about that.
To protect that top millimeter, we need that grazing animal. And that grazing animal grazes, but then it has four hooves that break up the capping in the soil and aerate the soil, because plants need nutrients, water, and air. So we've got to aerate the soil. And the raindrops over years have created the separation. The particle, when a raindrop hits bare soil, it creates a bomb crater, and then the particles re-fall based on gravity, biggest at the top, smallest at the bottom. And so the soil capping becomes an impenetrable layer. So we need the cow's four hooves to break up the capping, and then we need that all-important dung creator that comes out the back end, which is a perfect balance of N, P, and K. And when it spatters on the ground, that spattering on the ground and the interlockedness of them, it holds the sand particles in place and protects those soil microorganisms and fungi from ultraviolet light. And then the urine from the animal, when it goes through that biological carpet of dung, it's the urine that is needed to feed the bacteria, because as you know, bacteria are single cell organisms. They can only function in moisture. So they get their initial nutrients from the urine, not from the dung. And that's why taking dung out of dairies and spreading it on fields doesn't work.
Because why?
Well, firstly, because it's spread, and secondly, because of how it's separated from the urine.
Oh, okay. All right. So how would it work? How I live in the land in Vermont of dairy cows and Ben and Jerry, the ones that produce Ben and Jerry's ice cream. So how should we be managing those grasslands? Because that is what's here a lot, is rolling green hills like you see in a postcard.
Okay, so all of those cattle should be removed from Vermont and it should regrow as a forest. Because
well, that's what it was.
Vermont is what we call a non-brittle environment.
Right.
So in a non-brittle environment, you expect to have forest hogs and forest fowls, also known as chickens. So you should have hardwoods, deciduous woods, and fruiting trees, etc., etc. And under the forest and jungle canopy, you should have hogs and chickens. Now, those dairy cows, they need to be in a brittle environment.
I get it now. Okay, so you're starting way back. I mean, Vermont was wooded. I've seen pictures. And then they brought the sheep and the woolen industry and 80% unwooded.
No,
and now
I'm
it's
not starting
back.
Way back. Remember, we kill the animals. We chop everything down and we create a city. This is the same cycle we do over and over again.
Okay, so yeah, that is a term that I was unfamiliar with, the brittle and non-brittle. So why are grasslands called brittle environments?
So they're not called brittle environments, but in a brittle environment, you will always find a grassland. So
a brittle environment
is a place with a wet season and a dry season.
Okay.
A non-brittle environment is a place where there's atmospheric moisture year-round. And the micro water cycle functions.
Okay.
Atmospheric moisture at a micro level, at a molecular level.
Okay, so this is the real key. I when I heard you speak, I knew when you arrived on this topic of the micro water cycle. We can't appreciate anything that you're offering in the way of interesting, new, fresh ideas unless you really think about the micro water cycle. So take us down that rabbit hole in a fun way because, we're ordinary people.
Okay, so we all know about the water cycle. We all learned it in school. The water comes off the ocean, goes over the mountains, falls out of the sky, comes back down the rivers, and goes back out to the ocean. That was what we learned. Then a bit further on, we learned about the small water cycles. And I'm taking it another step to the micro water cycles, because what I've noticed is trapped in a grassland is this vapor.
Okay.
And it's literally vapor. Now, if you go to a big forest and you walk around a forest and you look up through this up to the sky, you'll see that same vapor. So the non-brittle environment forests have this air vapor. A grassland can have that same air vapor. And I've got clients who are reporting that, it hasn't rained in 2 months and I go for a walk in my field in the morning and my boots get wet. That is from the vapor touching their boots from the micro water cycle. So that is the moisture in the soil that is held and transported by the mycelium, traded with the plants. There's a mycelium that will pump water from over 30 meters deep. So that's 90 feet deep. It'll pump water back up to the soil surface to trade it for sugars from a plant. I mean, this is huge.
Okay, making sure we've got terms that people can use. So mycelium is
the roots of a fungus.
Yeah, the roots of a mushroom.
Yeah, yes, the roots of a mushroom, except it's way more complex.
But we need that. We need that. I mean, I'm sure maybe even 50 years ago, we didn't realize how important mycelium fungus and mushrooms were to forest cycles as well. Now that's a big topic as well. Okay,
well,
so.
I just want to add to that. I mean, when I was in school, we had the plant and the animal kingdom. We didn't even have the mushroom kingdom.
Right.
It didn't even exist. And yet we knew that the life cycle was birth, growth, death, and decay. Who's responsible for decay? Mycelium. It's the mushrooms that decay things. Don't believe me? Look at your bread left in the fridge.
Yes.
It's the mycelium. And so we can't have the life cycle without mycelium and mushrooms. And there are literally millions of species. So don't even try and understand that world.
Okay, so in your way of thinking, just as, you know, science discovered not that long ago that trees were almost talking to each other through the mycelium, you're pointing out that in grasslands, the mycelium are foundational to the transport of water, probably nutrients too.
So they're the brain of the grassland.
Yeah.
And they keep it all healthy and functioning. So they will pump water from down below and bring it back up to the surface to trade for sugars. They will kill plants. They will heal plants. They will keep pathogens in cattle and bison safe. I mean, you know, in grasslands where we've got a healthy mycelium, we find we don't have any foot and mouth. How is that possible? You know, foot and mouth on properties where the land's in bad condition, but in land where the land's in good condition, we don't have foot and mouth. They're helping everything. Because they were so microscopic and so misunderstood, humans just didn't get them. But you can't have a healthy functioning ecosystem without a healthy functioning mycelial network.
Okay. All right. So let's dig into the actual process. So you're looking at us recognizing when we have super depleted soils and we're on or just about into the desertification. That's a big word, that turning places that shouldn't be desert into desert.
Mm-hmm.
And how does this whole process get started? What do you do? Like, you're talking about 150,000 acres at a shot. What do you do first? How's the process go?
So with anything, we're in such bad condition. Like, just for example, in America, I'm not going to count the Sahara or the Middle East or the Australian outback. Let's just look at America. In America, we have 200 million acres at risk of desertifying.
Okay. Becoming a desert.
Becoming a desert. We have 81 million acres already desert.
Did not know that.
Mm-hmm. So how about we just figure out over the next 20 years, I've got a plan to just fix 20 million of those 81 million acres. And we can do it per project or per state at 150,000 acres per year. There's many reasons I've chosen that number. One, it's already within the realms of what our human brains can handle. So there's a feedlot business in Texas that already has 500,000 cattle in a feedlot. To do 150,000 acres of land a year, we would only need 600,000 cattle. So, you know, if we already know that feedlots can feed this many animals, if we just get rid of the feedlot and turn it into a biological carpeting instrument, it's already something that we can wrap our heads around. We're literally just repurposing what we've got. And then the second part of it is we've got to start with the low-hanging fruit. So many of our deserts butt right up against rivers. And in the river areas, we have irrigated fields.
Right.
So to fix the desert, we start by growing the forage for those grazing animals in the river areas, on the currently irrigated areas. And instead of shipping that hay to China, we just ship the hay 30 miles into the desert, and then 50 miles into the desert, and then 70 miles into the desert as we expand. But we start as close to the irrigation areas as possible, because by starting there, we also start healing the soil. So more water goes into the aquifer, more water gets trapped and stays, and we have those rivers start to flow again. So the idea is the biological carpet is near irrigated areas. We take the forage grown in the irrigated areas, and we take the cattle out of feedlots and we put them into the desert. We now feed them in the desert so that they break up the soil crusting and leave the biological carpet behind.
Okay. All right. Now I see what you're proposing. Okay, great. So which came first? I think that we came up with feedlots for convenience, didn't we? Or did we come up with feedlots because we'd already ruined the soils where we used to feed the cattle?
We were ruining the soils where we used to feed the cattle, yeah. The thing about feedlots, it's actually quite sad and quite complex. So we grew a lot of corn during the Cold War. And the corn was our way of fighting the Soviet Union. And it was a military operation to get everyone growing corn so that we could, you know, show that our capitalism was better than their communism. The byproduct of that was we had a lot of excess corn. How do you get rid of excess corn? Well, if you put it into cows, they'll gain weight, et cetera, et cetera. So we used to ship the corn and the cattle to California. Then some smart guys in Texas went, hold on, we grow the corn here, we have the cattle here, why don't we just have the feedlots here? So then they started feedlotting in Texas and then just shipping the meat. But it was all based on linear decision making. And yeah, none of it was based on the decision to, hey, let's have the happiest, healthiest farmers. Remember, in the 1980s, we lost 600 family farmers a year due to our agricultural policies. So we lost 6 million farmers in a decade. And it hasn't worked. It isn't working. We've created sterile soils over vast areas. We've lost all the families. We've lost all the rural communities. We've lost everything. And that's the 200 million acres at risk. I just want to work on showing the world that we can fix the 81 million, start with 150,000 acres a year. And as soon as I've shown people how easy it is, the idea will get mimicked. And you'll watch this pop up in Australia and Middle East, and it'll pop up everywhere because everything is impossible until you show people how easy it is. As soon as they can see how easy it is, everyone says, oh, we knew that all along.
Okay, so what I hear you saying is that in this process that you're envisioning, you've got really bad soils, you put livestock on it, and the livestock between their hooves breaking up the ground and their dung and their urine, you're adding that organic, almost like an organic shower cap across the top of the soil. So it reduces the ability of the UV light to get to that 1 millimeter. So all this organic substrate that you've got there can start to work its way down into the soil and things can come back to life. Is that sort of the gist of it?
That's sort of the gist of it. And with that, as you said, that shower cap, that allows us to start, bare soil has 84% evaporation of the precipitation that falls, often in as little as half an hour, mostly within a day. Covered soils only have 10% evaporation. So let's, your listeners, take your calculators out and say that in the worst desert in America, we have 3.5 inches of rain. And then calculate that by the acre or the hectare. If you do it by the hectare, it's much easier. Turn 3.5 inches into millimeters, and then 1 millimeter of rain equals 1 liter of water per square meter. So it's really easy to do the math. And then just do the math and say, if we had 3 inches of rain and 85% evaporated, how much would we have left in the soil? And then if we had 3 inches of rain and 10% evaporated, how much would we have in the soil? And then multiply it by 81 million acres and see the massive difference. Now, when that water is staying in our soils and becoming part of the micro water cycle, I promise you we have solved climate change.
Because you're talking about changing weather patterns after we can do 10 years of 150,000 acres a year. It's about the micro and the macro water
So
cycle.
the micro leads into the small water cycle. The small water cycle is your afternoon thunderstorms. If you have a functioning micro water cycle, you can then have the small water cycle, which is that evapotranspiration goes into the atmosphere with enough abundance and enough, believe it or not, mycelium spores. The mushroom spores are what moisture connects to make a raindrop. It's all connected. It is so freaky how it is all connected. But it all starts with us needing the biocarpet to jumpstart the life cycle, fix the micro water cycle that leads to the small water cycle being fixed that will reduce the daytime highs and the nighttime lows that will decrease the severity of storms that we're experiencing now because you won't have these giant fluctuations. So you'll have a more mellow climate. And because now there's more atmospheric moisture, you can have those afternoon thunderstorms that then perpetuate it. It's all connected. We have to do it. And I just don't know how we get humans to say, right, we've got no experience with fixing a desert. We've only created two-thirds of the planet into deserts. We don't know how to do it, but here's a weird, crazy guy, and he'd like to just try it on 150,000 acres a year. Why don't we give it a shot? because actually this shows a lot of promise to solve all these issues that we're all complaining about.
So you have actually have sort of designs on an area that's in real trouble called the Salton Sea. Talk to us about that project.
So I chose the Salton Sea because not only was it a low-hanging fruit near irrigation, there's irrigation south and north of the Salton Sea, but also because there's a moisture channel that comes up from the Baja, comes north behind the Los Angeles Mountains. Then the trade winds pick it up and it goes then off towards Kansas and Texas. When that moisture coming up from Baja hits the hot air of the Imperial Valley, it gets blocked and stopped. Okay. If it gets blocked and stopped, Kansas and Texas have a drought.
Because we're talking about LA here, right?
San Diego to LA, but behind the mountains.
Okay.
If that moisture gets blocked and stopped, Texas and Kansas have a drought. If we can cool the Imperial Valley with the biological carpeting, that extreme heat will not be evaporating off the baking hot sand. The moisture from Baja will make it up to join the jet stream and Texas and Kansas droughts will stop. There's two places that I've observed in the on the globe. One is the Sinai Peninsula and the other is this Imperial Valley that if we can fix those two points, we actually solve a lot of global climate change, drought, desert, rainfall issues. So it's a key point that, and that's why I chose it. But more importantly, because humans need to see it as believe it, we got Hollywood right over the hill. So as soon as we do it, Hollywood can see it. And if Hollywood says it's real, well, then 6 billion people on the planet know it's real.
So what's keeping this from happening? Like, what do you need to have happen next?
We've done a lot of the social media. We've done a lot of the podcasts. We've done a lot of the image things. We've done all our planning. Now we've just got to put it into a form that people with money understand so that it's investable. And I speak cow shit and cows and plants. I don't speak financial silo, you know, venture capital. I don't speak that language. I'm very mathematical, so I know my numbers are good, but I don't speak their language. And so there's literally a lost in translation issue between the financial markets who have to fund it and the weird scientists who know how to do it.
Because this is not some sort of charitable, everybody kumbaya around the campfire. You have a This is an economic model that benefits regions too, right?
Oh, hugely, yeah. In holistic management, remember at the beginning of this podcast, I said socially, economically, and environmentally sound. Any decision I make has got to help the society and culture. It's to help the society and culture, you've got to make money to be able to do it. To fix the environment, you've got to make money, otherwise no one's going to pay for it. So yes, this is a profitable model. And a lot of the land is government, so the real estate model gets left out of it. But if it was private land, then there's the real estate goes up from $2,000 to $30,000 an acre. But on government land, you get paid for ecosystem services, because the people in Phoenix, the people in LA, the people in the cities around these deserts, they are suffering the effects of climate change. So they would like a cooler environment around them and a more stable environment. So hopefully governments can pay for those services. But just the fact that you're taking an animal that you buy at the market for, let's call it $800 to $1,000, you feed it for a year, nice organic, you know, biodiverse forage. The retail value on that is about $8,000. There's room between $800 and $8,000. There's room in that spread to pay for the project.
Okay, so that was just a bit of a leap for me. So in the agricultural model of raising a cow, let's say, if it's on a feedlot, it's worth $800 to the person who's feeding?
When a feedlot buys it, it's worth $800. When it gets sold in Walmart, it's worth $8,000.
So what happens with this regenerative agriculture or the value? Where does that work in?
Well, so same thing. So when my clients, when I teach them how to remove themselves from the commodity market and start, you know, selling their own products, that they get these same kind of figures. You know, most of them are selling their cows for between $6,000 and $8,000. And whereas if they take that same cow and sell it at the sale barn, they'll only get $800.
Oh, this is huge.
yeah, it is.
Yeah, okay.
And multiply that by 600,000 cattle, and the numbers are quite smileable.
Okay, so this is starting to make sense to me. Incredible sense. What's the hang up? What's the hitch? Why aren't people just saying, yeah, this sounds perfectly logical. Of course I don't want to have my 100 acres, 1,000 acres, 8,000 acres be a hard pan wilderness of tumbleweeds. Why would someone not want an option that would promise lush growth and all the value that comes with that?
So remember I said my father had come up with four missing keys?
Yes.
I've come up with the fifth one, and it's called instinctual fear.
Ah, okay.
Instinctual fear is fear of the unknown. And it can be fear of success, fear of failure, fear of you name it. We use fear to justify everything. And what I've found in my research is that it takes humans three generations of the pioneers, the 1 to 5% being the pathfinders, before the rest of the population will jump on board. We're only beginning the second generation of this knowledge now. So I might be able to do this project with the 5% risk takers, but we will not be able to get the rest to jump on board until instinctual fear, which is a matter of time, can be dealt with. So that's the one part of it. The second part of it is basically because I haven't asked for the money yet. And the reason is I've done this project. I almost pulled it off in the UAE, and the Sheikh who was going to fund it drove home and asked his Pakistani driver what he thought of it. And he said, "Ah, boss, you're being conned." And after agreeing that night, and we were going to sign the documents the next day, he pulled the project. Instinctual fear. He didn't want to look foolish. And then in Australia, we did a similar project. We spent 4 years setting it up. Same thing. Instinctual fear. One person caused the project to collapse. So I don't get excited, and I don't rush into anything now, because in modern language, we'd say I've had my fingers burnt.
Yeah.
But it's not really fingers burnt. I just have a deeper understanding of humans. And I'm not rushing into it because they have a lot of fears to overcome. So I'm cautiously, slowly trying to put the right financial team together, people I trust implicitly. I have to trust them. You know, I look at Steve Jobs. You know, he got kicked out of his own company. I'm not interested in getting this up and running and then getting kicked out. Because my ideas, I have so much more in here, way beyond this biological carpeting, that I want to get done. So I need a financial team that I trust. And then I want to hear the financial team, how do they want to structure it? Because I want many people to benefit from healing our planet. As in, I want this, when it goes bigger to the 600,000 cattle size, I want people to be able to buy shares so they can feel like they are part of the solution. Because we've got so many bad messages out there. It would be great to give a lot of people hope and say, yeah, no, I own shares in that project. And yeah, we're making a difference. And we've turned 5 million, 10 million, 15 million acres of desert back into grassland. You know, I want people to be able to be part of it and grow with it. So when my financial team is ready and they present to me a plan for how the financial silo works that will meet my requirements, then I will pull the trigger and say, okay, let's go for it.
Yeah, lovely. I love your concept about it takes three generations of innovators to get something to just become ubiquitous. Yeah. Do you have some good stories about where we've seen this happen either purposefully or not purposefully out there, where wildlife areas and ecological restoration have been happening?
So my favorite story is Australia. I got asked by the government of Australia to work with three farmers in the Collinsville region of northern Queensland. And as long as they all agreed to read the books on holistic management and work with me for 1 year, I agreed to work with them. So they asked me what I would do on each property. And I told them And then they set up a camera that took a photo every 10 minutes of the day, 24 hours a day, to make sure I wasn't cheating. And okay. I'm so grateful for that camera, because it showed when we put every image into a video, it's just the most beautiful thing to watch. Unfortunately, I don't have the rights to it. It's owned by the Australian government.
Yeah.
But it's a lovely video. I wish I literally wish I could share it. But in this, we had a gully on the O'Sullivan's ranch, or station as they call it there. And we agreed to make a couple of thousand cattle sleep for 1 week at a time over this gully. And then they went out and they strip grazed in this, you know, couple of thousand acre paddock. Now, this was in the worst drought in 17 years in Australia, when the majority of property owners were shooting cattle that were dying of starvation in their paddocks. So normally at a field day in Australia, 20 people might come to a field day, but word had got out and about 300 people came to the field day. So we spent the morning just us all giving a talk about what had happened. And then after the talk, one of the government, call him an extension officer, stood up and he was highly respected, Dr. such and such, stood up and he berated me. And he wanted to know why I was lying to all these people. And what did I hope to gain from lying to all these 300 people? And there was no way that anything I claimed was true. And the property owner, who's a big, strong Aussie, he just stood up and he said, "Hey, you haven't seen it yet, so why don't you just sit down and shut up?" And Barry's a big enough guy that the guy very quickly sat down and shut up. Anyway, long story short, we then in the afternoon, we went out to the pasture. Now, we made the cars park in a laneway, and then they had a couple of hundred meter walk down to where the gully was. And we had a marquee set up, and we had a whole bunch of cooler boxes full of beers, because Australians always have a beer until midnight after one of these field days, because it's the only time the community really comes together, because they live so remotely and it's their time to get together and chat and socialize. So we knew their culture and we set it up so that they could all enjoy. We walk them into this gully, and the forage is overhead high. The walk from where they parked to the gully, the forage was knee high and thick. Now, this is in the worst drought in 17 years. This pasture and gully and everything went from 3 varieties of forage to 17. So it had 14 new species appeared, and we'd done no seeding. And that camera had filmed that we'd done no seeding. That Townsville lucerne that went extinct in 1979 was as thick as snot all over that pasture again. But so everyone saw this mind-blowing change. At the end, when we said, "Okay, there's beers in the marquee, let's go and discuss," not one Aussie had a beer. 300 people quietly walked back to their cars, got in their cars and drove away. They were in too much of a shock, because the change they had seen when they knew their cows were dying of starvation with the exact same rainfall that this ranch had got, they just couldn't comprehend. So that gully was healed, that pasture was healed, and I did it with biological carpeting in the worst drought in 17 years.
Wow.
So now they have that program to heal gullies all over that range, because those gullies flow into the Great Barrier Reef, and it's their Great Barrier Reef program where they're now healing land on the land to save the coral in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. That's one of my more fun stories. Now, would I love to replicate that on 150,000 acres? Yes.
Yeah.
So,
well, you never know whose ears this interview might fall on. We're going to do our best to get it out. So, you know, as we wrap up here, you know, yeah, we all, you know, look at the news, or we look in our social media at concepts that are related to what we're passionate about. And then sometimes we're like, "Yay, a win," or we're like, "Oh boy." Tell me, mm-hmm. if there's one thing that, if we'd only had 3 minutes for this interview, if there's one thing that you really wish people knew, what would it be?
How easy it will be for us once we've made the decision to heal the deserts of the planet and get climate change under control. It will solve our overpopulation problems. It will solve our climate extreme problems. It will solve our protein problems for a growing human population. I mean, even if you read the Bible, I'm not religious, but if you read the Bible, it even says if we solve this problem, the world as we know it will be a better place. And I believe the world as we know it will be a better place if we can get biological carpeting started in America on the scale we need to do it.
All right. Well, I'm probably never going to, I live on a farm in Vermont, grew up on a farm in Illinois, and I'm probably never going to think about farming the same way anymore. I am so glad that you decided to join us on the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. Roger Savory, I love to talk to people that about like you who are passionate about a way forward that leads to, like we talked about in the beginning, two generations thanking us for the brave decisions we made so far back. Can't thank you enough for spending time with us.
Thank you very much. And let's hope that we can create a team who are willing to make those brave decisions.
Okay. So where can people go next to either learn more about what you do or connect with you directly? Where can we send people?
Fixdeserts.com is where I've set it up. And there's a contact page and a subscribe page. I really would like people to subscribe and get their friends and family to subscribe. There's a bit of a theory behind that. If we can get 60,000 subscribers, then we have some political clout to push back against the government regulations getting in our way, which will prevent us getting started. Yeah, we've got the same page on Facebook, but the actual one at fixdeserts.com and subscribe, that's the real powerful one that we need. And then you can contact me through that. My PA, Sherry, will get everything through to me.
Great. And, you know, I do have to say you are a good public speaker, and I'd like to recommend that people invite you to speak at events as well, because the word gets out when it comes from folks like you who can get up on a stage. Like I saw you at Sea Change. You had, I think, probably 14 minutes or something, very little, and you managed to explain this whole thing in a very entertaining and fun way. And I think we were all eyebrows raised sitting there going, whoa, wait a minute, how come we didn't know about this? I know that you had a line of people standing to talk to you after your talk. The swarm effect was definitely in place. So thank you, Roger, for joining us at the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. I hope that the cracks of light and the sense of possibility that we've started with this conversation about agriculture and a regenerative life for our grandchildren is something that puts a spring in your step for the rest of your day. And you'll join us next week. Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it.